Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Lots of chervil, tarragon, chives, parsley, dill, and then many of the other things that I'm purchasing are just things we use every day, but now that we get to buy them from our local friends.
That's Candace Finch of Finch's Brasserie. She's stocking up on staple ingredients to use at the restaurant. And that's right, we're reporting from the Bloomington Community Farmers Market today, checking out what's for sale, talking to some farmers and customers, and just enjoying this community event. Later in the program, we chat with a couple foragers who give tips and tricks for finding morels and ramps. And in the kitchen today, Chef Daniel Orr prepares a dessert using an edible flower that's in bloom all over the place these days, red buds. Spring certainly is in full effect today on Earth Eats. Mia Partlow brings us the news headlines every week, so tossing it over to you, Mia.
Two big things happened this week, Annie, both having to do with farm animals. Antibiotics, which are often used on livestock to promote weight gain and to reduce the spread of illness in crowded barns, can currently be purchased over-the-counter by farmers. New guidelines issued this week by the FDA hope to change that by stipulating that farmers should use antibiotics only to treat illness in livestock, and then only under the supervision of a veterinarian. Scientists have long cautioned that the overuse of antibiotics in livestock for non-medical purposes has contributed to an increase in antibiotic-resistant bacteria in animals and humans. Factory farms are more likely than small farms to use antibiotics to preempt illness and spur animal growth. This is because smaller farms tend to keep their livestock in cleaner, less crowded environments. Still, some people worry that the new guidelines will have a greater negative effect on small farmers than on large agribusinesses. Critics are also quick to note that the FDA's new recommendations are guidelines, which means they are not legally binding. The agency is relying on cooperation from drug manufacturers to ensure the guidelines are met. And egg-laying chickens made the news in a big way this week. An undercover video released yesterday by the Humane Society offers a behind-the-scenes glimpse into conditions at a Kreider Farms egg factory. The footage shows hens crammed into 54 to 58-inch cages, mummified carcasses strewn amongst the living, a thick layer of dead flies covering the floor, and the list goes on. Kreider Farms spokesperson Dave Andrews insists the depiction is a distortion and not representative of how the company treats its flock generally. The expose comes on the heels of the passage of two new state laws that prohibit would-be whistleblowers from bringing recording equipment surreptitiously into factory farms located in Iowa and Utah. Industry executives frame the controversial legislation in terms of criminal defamation, but opponents of so-called ag gag measures worry about what will happen to livestock should farming practices grow even more opaque. Similar bills are currently being considered in Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, New York, and Tennessee. You can read more about these stories on our website. While you're there, read an interview with John Milligan of Shacked Farms, who sells eggs laid by hens that live and graze in southern Indiana. And get tips on how to start your own backyard chicken flock. It doesn't get much more local than that.
You bet. And check out the conversations on our Twitter feed and Facebook page, where we're collecting your tips for getting kids to like veggies. And we had a lively conversation with Alton Brown of the Food Network on Twitter last night. You have to read it to believe it. Just search for Earth Eats. The Bloomington Community Farmers Market is ringing in its 38th year this season. This morning, the parking lot next to the Showers building is buzzing with more vendors and more customers than I've seen in the recent years. Perhaps that's because there's not a cloud in the sky right now, which is sort of lucky because weather in early April can be really unpredictable. I tracked down the person responsible for managing what goes down every Saturday morning.
My name is Robin Hobson. And my title is Market Master.
Really? What does that mean?
My surmise is that it might come from having a harbor master who guides, you know, ships in and out of, a harbor or a bay.
So you have a big job.
It feels big, but the fun part is here where you get to be at the market.
So how many people do we have here today, if you could estimate?
I would say today we'll see about 4,000 people come to the market, and we have about 60, maybe just a hair over 60 vendors, which is a pretty good showing for the first market in April. Last year, there were 5 Saturdays in April, and it rained hard for 3 of them. So it's lovely to see a seamless sky today, plus the spring is early, so we're seeing a few things that we would not normally see till a little bit later in the year, like strawberries. There's a lot of people growing strawberries in high tunnels, so that kind of extends the season for that. But they're here. I'm seeing cucumbers, which is probably something else coming out of a high tunnel season extension.
And so that's in addition to like all the greens and bedding plants, like flowers and herbs that we typically see this time of year. So Robin, in your experience, how have you seen the market change and develop over the years?
I think the biggest change in the last 10 years has been that people are finding more of an enterprise in the farmers market. Their farm business has expanded, and they're doing much more commerce than they were a few years ago. And I think, you know, all the hoo-ha around, you know, buying local and seeking out farmers, it's the expression of that is right here.
Then let's look ahead, let's say mid-July when the market is really humming. What does this whole scene look like?
Well, the market will be totally full in July. We will have probably no extra spaces, or perhaps going into an overflow situation where we're creating more spaces for vendors to be in. We will see crowds of 10,000, but it's really, it's quite a scene.
The clanging of finger cymbals is coming from the dance troupe Dark Side Tribal, just one of the many groups performing around the market today. I'm walking around to get a feel for what vendors are selling and what customers are buying. Candace Finch of Finch's Brasserie is at the Heartland Family Farms table, poring over a very long grocery list.
Well, I'm actually purchasing wild garlic and watercress and baby carrots. And I'm looking for peas, although no one has them just yet. Lots of chervil, tarragon, chives, parsley, dill.
So of the stuff that you're going to get today, can you imagine what dishes will come of them?
Well, the wild garlic will be a wild garlic butter. Watercress we have on our menu right now with our wild striped bass entree, which comes with a lobster stock risotto and a radish and watercress salad. It's really nice. So that's what that is for. And then many of the other things that I'm purchasing are just things we use every day. But now that we get to buy them from our local friends. It's good to see you.
My name's Jim Lewis.
Old Post Gardens?
Yeah, Old Post Gardens. Old Post is one of the early names for Vincennes, back when it was actually just a trading post.
I was attracted to your carrots. They're absolutely gorgeous. Well, I'm sort of surprised to see them so early.
Well, they're overwintered carrots. I planted them last fall, and carrots over winter actually taste better. The starches over the winter turn into sugars.
And these are smaller than what I would normally see later in the season. Is that part of it?
Part of it, plus that's the variety. There's so many different varieties of carrots. You know, you can get gigantic carrots or baby carrots. So this is a combination of early picking and just the size of the carrot.
Bought a lot of stuff, and I was like, I gotta talk to her.
Yeah, sure.
So can you tell me what you bought?
Yeah, I bought some butternut squash, kale, collards, and some green onions.
You didn't just buy some butternut squash, you bought 4. What are you going to do with that?
I live in the Bloomington Co-op. So I live, my house, we have 14 people in it. So we spend about $50 to $70 at the farmer's market. So we try to buy like half of our produce here.
So can you tell me, like, can you imagine what you're going to do, like, recipe-wise with this stuff?
Yeah, so the butternut squash, we do a lot of different things. We do, like, a butternut crumble, like an apple crumble, but with butternut. So that's super good. The kale, we'll put it in a salad, just fresh kale, or we'll sauté it or throw it in a soup as well. We do a bunch of different things, yeah.
Yeah. Kelsey Smith studies nutritional science at Indiana University. Before that, it was Jim Lewis, who runs his old post gardens in Vincennes, Indiana. Candace Finch is of Finch's Brasserie in Bloomington. And three jazz musicians from the Mayo Jazz Program provided the soundtrack. Quinn Sternberg, Chris Parker, and Wes Schrimsher. Go to the website to hear additional interviews and check out the photo gallery to get the feel for what it's really like at the Bloomington Community Farmers Market. EarthEats.org. Not all edible treats are grown in gardens or on farms. Some of the most interesting foodstuffs this time of year grow wild. Morel hunters, for instance, see the blooming of the redbud trees as an indication that their coveted mushrooms are now in season. But these beautiful pink flowers aren't just nice to look at. You can eat them, too. They're a member of the legume family, right along with beans and peas. They have pea pods, and if you pick them when they're really young, they're tender, so you can use them just like you would snow peas. It's just the flowers in this dessert recipe. We're using them as a garnish for local yogurt, meringue cookies, and local berries. Take it away, Chef Daniel Orr.
So we have the red buds here, and I've just pulled them off the tree. It's best to do it kind of after you've had a nice rain and they're nice and fresh and rinsed off. I've got prepared here some meringues, and if you don't know what a meringue is, it's basically just sugar and egg whites that have been beaten together until they're really light and fluffy. I've colored these a little bit with some green and pink colors for spring. And what we're going to do is use this one here, which is kind of like a flattened hockey puck looking thing, and we're just going to put some plain old yogurt in there, and what's going to happen is that yogurt will have, you know, that acid flavor that will combat that real sweetness of the meringue.
Now, the thing with meringues, I've heard, is they're a little tricky to make, especially if you're in humid weather. Is that correct?
They're not tricky to make. They're tricky to store. All right, so what you need to do if you make some homemade meringues is put them in a real airtight container so the moisture and humidity don't get into the meringue. I'm going to top this with some berries. I've got some blueberries and some blackberries. We're going to drizzle it with a little bit of Hunter's Farm honey. Okay, I'm just going to put a little bit of blueberry compote, but you could use some blueberry jam or whatever kind of berry sauce you want. A compote basically is a mixture of sugar and fruits that you cook down, and you can season that with different spices and different flavorings. So it's another way of preserving fruit. So if you're out there picking blackberries and you don't know what to do with them, you can make a compote. The introduction of sugar into something like that is actually another preservative. It makes the fruit last longer. It has at least, you know, 2 to 3 weeks shelf life after you've cooked it down with a bunch of sugar. A little more yogurt and finish it up with some of those beautiful red buds, just kind of cascading down off the top of the meringue.
The flowers from other legumes, like beans and peas, are sweet. For a more bitter, peppery taste, try eating decorative flowers like marigolds, peonies, carnations, and nasturtiums. But don't take my word for it. Read an interview with our resident flower expert, Moya Andrews. While you're there, check out our recipe for stuffed squash blossoms. Really, really good. It's all at eartheats.org. Coming up, a morel hunter talks about why this season has been especially weird. And we cook with ramps, another forage delicacy that won't be around the market for much longer. Stay with us.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. You can find morel mushrooms at the market this time of year, but you better be prepared to shell out upwards of $35 a pound for them. For folks hoping to find some for themselves, looking around ash, poplar, and elm trees after a good rain when the temperatures are around 70 degrees really is the key. But even then, it can sort of feel like looking for a needle in a haystack. I speak from experience there. So mushroom lovers tend to defer to seasoned foragers who have their spots that they return to year after year.
If there's, I don't know, 3 or 4 pounds.
Well, last Sunday I found 27 and a half pounds, 17 and a half around one tree. The second best tree of my life. About 7 years ago, I hit a 19 and a half pound tree in that same valley, which doesn't happen very often.
That's forager Brian Snyder. With all the foraging he's done there, he estimates the valley produced 30 to 40 pounds of morels this season alone.
Actually, I'm going back there today.
I sort of want to ask to tag along, but I know that morel hunting spots are like hidden secrets that people don't share.
Yeah, it's this spot I wouldn't reveal.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're getting 17 pounds at a time...
It looks like someone's here to buy stuff.
Oh, yeah, sure, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, I saw your sign, mushrooms for sale. Have you got any?
I do.
He sells the morels out of his house, located on the edge of Yellowwood State Forest in Brown County, Indiana. He's a pro, having foraged for morels in southern Indiana for 25 years.
Thanks.
Hey, was it Larry?
Yeah.
Good to meet you.
Thanks.
You're welcome. See ya. Perfect timing.
Do people just randomly stop by? You get that
they
a lot?
Do. I've had a sign out for about a month, and people are just now starting to hunt, and it's really almost over.
He started finding morels on February 27th this year, weeks earlier than most years.
You know, it's never been this early. Peak season should be the 20th through the 27th of April, and it's going to be completely over this year.
Earlier this year, the USDA updated its plant hardiness zone map for the first time since 1990. The results show that the U.S. is getting warmer. The hardiness is determined by the average lowest temperature in the area. Since many places are not as cold as they used to be, different plants and trees can now survive farther north. Snyder speculates this might have something to do with the early bird morel season.
I mean, actually, we're on Tennessee time, because I would go pick them in Tennessee, and this is about the time I would be down there.
But the season isn't completely over yet. If you want to try your hand at foraging for mushrooms, Snyder recommends hunting around ash and poplar trees on northeast-facing hillsides. Or you could do what he does and look around elm trees, if you can find them.
Well, you got to cover a lot of ground to hunt elms. You know, you may look around 15, 20 cracked elms before they're going to put up mushrooms, but I've never found 17 and a half pound around a poplar tree.
Ramps are another springtime delicacy coveted by foragers. Just like morels, they only pop up for a few weeks each year, usually mid-April through early May, when it's still cool at night, in the 60s and 70s during the day, and rainy. As temperatures get hotter, they bolt, go to seed, and then wait until next season. They're similarly tough to find in the wild, but according to Chef Bob Adkins, they're worth all the trouble.
They're a member of the onion family, the alliums, but they taste like some of the most pleasant garlic and onion flavor you could ever have, really. I wouldn't say they're mild, but they aren't as astringent, I think, as cultivated onions are. They're very useful, more so than a lot of members of the family, because the leaves are so tender. They can be pureed almost like basil for a pesto. They can be sauteed like spinach. They can even be eaten raw, small amounts tossed into salads to give an extra kick. And then as you move down, the maroon and the white parts are more for solely cooking, but you toss them with like scrambled eggs or home fries and bacon, something like that. And that's the way they eat them in West Virginia and the Virginia, the kind of Appalachian states, tossed with fried potatoes and bacon along with some sweet peppers, stuff like that.
Adkins found this batch while on a fishing trip, and he discovered that he's not the only one who covets ramps.
I found these about a week and a half ago when I was out fishing on my own, and they were still pretty small. But I picked enough for myself to take home and eat that evening. And I'd been fishing for about an hour and a half beforehand, hadn't caught a fish. I started picking these, and immediately after I picked them, you touched the bait again, and I ended up catching like 8 or 10 more bass through that day.
Ramps loved by people and fish alike, apparently. Listen to my complete conversation with Chef Bob Adkins and find out even more about foraging on our website, eartheats.org. And now, let's head to the kitchen. Oh, ramps.
So do you recognize these little guys?
These, did Chef Bob pick these?
Yes, these are ramps from Chef Bob's secret patch. The thing about ramps is it's a very fleeting season. You can find the flowering heads after they've kind of, you know, passed the edible stage. And you want to let those be, but burn that into your mind so next year in the spring you can go back and find them. There's only one foraged item that I would suggest that you pick clear, and that's the wild garlic mustard greens, which is very invasive. But with the ramps, always leave some, so next year there'll be another supply of them. We're going to do a pickled ramp, and then we're also going to do a ramp pesto. So what we've done is we've cut off these green tops, and I've put them in a nice pickling jar, and we're going to make a brine to pour over them, and then we can keep them in the refrigerator for, you know, 6 months, 8 months, a year, and you can utilize that vinegar for the flavor into vinaigrettes and sauces and things, and then you can also pull out the ramps and eat them like pickles, let's say with a cheese platter or with smoked meats, things like that. You can use them in lots of different things. You can also chop them up and put them in a sauce or sprinkle them on top of a roasted fish. So there's lots of ways you can use them. We're going to go over to the stove. I've got a pan on, and we're going to show you how to do a quick brine. All right, so I've got about 2 cups of vinegar.
Any type of vinegar here?
I'm using cider vinegar, but really whatever you want. If you have, you know, maybe some homemade tarragon vinegar, or you have some rice wine vinegar, you could go a little Asian with the rice wine vinegar. You may throw in some star anise if you wanted to. So, you know, just whatever direction you want to go. But basically, it's the acid that we're looking for. About 1.5 cups of granulated sugar, and about 2 or 3 teaspoons of salt. And then I've got some spices. And today I've got some homegrown bay leaves that I keep in the house all winter and then take out and put in the garden in the summertime. And then I've got a little bit of cinnamon stick, some cloves, some crushed red pepper, and then some coriander and fennel seeds. Now, if you're really against sugar, you could use honey or agave syrup. What you're looking for is just to bring out that sweetness. So you could put maple syrup in this too, which would be another flavor. You have to be careful with a glass container when you put hot liquids in it that it won't crack. Just add a little vinegar at a time, and you're going to temper the glass, let it heat up slightly before adding a whole lot of the vinegar mixture. Okay, and you want to get all those spices and the bay leaves and cinnamon, everything down in there. Okay, we're going to seal this, and this is just a standard pickling jar, and you've got a beautiful batch of pickled ramps. Come back in 2 weeks, and I'll let you taste them.
You got it. You cut the leaves off. Why are we not pickling the leaves?
Well, the leaves would turn a kind of a dark, ugly color. So that's why we separate the bulbs and the greens, and we're going to make the pesto with the greens. So that's the next recipe. We've got everything for that right here. And you can see I've got the leaves here, which I've just blanched. And blanching is having a boiled salted water. And you drop your vegetables in it, you cook them to set the color, pull them out, and you plunge them into a ice bath, which stops the cooking, so you get the nice greens. And it partially tenderizes them, but will make it easier for the blender to chop them up. And this will make about 2 to 3 cups of pesto, and you can put that in small containers and then pull it out whenever you need to. They are kind of garlicky, but I like to add a couple cloves of regular garlic. Just to kind of intensify that, we're going to add a pinch of salt, a couple of flecks of pressed red pepper, and then I'm going to start adding the oil. I'll get a little in here to get started, maybe about 1/4 cup. And we've got a nice thick puree, which you can see here, and you can smell that. It's got a nice oniony, garlicky aroma to it. If you're going to freeze it, I'd freeze it just like that. But if you're going to use it right away, you can add cheese. Okay, we'll give it a little taste.
I love that garlic.
You know, it's kind of subtle and velvety in the beginning, and then it has that real garlic kick at the ends.
Now, you have the hot sauce here. Not to tell you how to use your mojo, but I would love some hot sauce.
Yeah, well, I like to add a couple drops in. Again, it's to taste. This does have some habaneros in it, so I'm just going to add probably about a teaspoon.
Chef Bob Atkins has become our resident ramps expert, so I tracked him down to taste the finished product.
Oh, no expert.
You picked these.
I did pick these.
And so now we turned it into a pesto. What do you think?
It's fabulous. It's got a nice bite. It's rich. A lot of different flavors and textures. This would be excellent over a pasta with some grilled chicken or grilled shrimp. Perfect.
And this is 2 or 3 weeks after I spoke with you last when you forged those ramps. Did you find any more? Have you gone back?
I did. This is probably the last picking that we'll get. They've grown a little bit more, but their bulbs have also gotten bigger, more like onion bulbs than the straight stalks we had before. And they got a lot more flavor down in the whites of the bulbs. So these pickles the chef made also were going to be really fabulous too.
If you haven't had enough ramps yet...
I have not had enough ramps yet. Okay, keep it coming.
You are going to be doing a roasted fish wrapped in ramps.
Whoa. Okay. So obviously we're going to be using the leaves primarily.
Yes. Great recipe. Another way to use the fresh ramps. You take the greens, blanch them in hot boiling salted water, shock them in the ice water, and then what we've done here is we've wrapped the ramps around little pieces of cod. And we're going to take them over and sauté them. Okay, hot pan, cold oil, and you'll see that when we put these in, they're going to kind of puff up a little bit. The ramps will puff up as they cook.
Oh, they're popping and crackling. Get me out of this pan!
I think they like it. Okay, I'm going to turn down the heat a little bit and just let this cook through. Now, with any fish, you always want to buy the best, the freshest. It should smell sweetly of the sea. It should never smell fishy. And so that's what you're looking for when you buy fish. You know, you want it to, if you touch a piece of fish, you want it to bounce back. You want the flesh to bounce back. If it kind of leaves a fingerprint on it, that means that the proteins have started to deteriorate. And you don't want to overcook it. That's the biggest problem people have with cooking fish is overcooking it. So you want it to be a little translucent in the center and more opaque on the outside. All right, so we've got this ramp crusted cod, and I'm just going to present it on a plate. Okay, I've just drizzled a little bit of fresh lemon juice on top, and I always like to do that with any of my fish dishes. It just, you know, the citrus just kind of accentuates that wonderful briny sea flavor. Okay, and then I've got some of that ramp pesto we made, and that's all there is to it.
As always, check out the recipes and see photos of all the dishes we make on Earth Eats. There are tons of other recipes from our bloggers as well, so you'll surely find something that uses all the goodies you just bought at the farmer's market. Find us at eartheats.org.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Carrie Boyce, executive producer.
We're taking the next 2 weeks off, so in the meantime, visit our website and read seasonal recipes, news stories, and interviews. We're also looking to hear your stories and see your pictures from the farmers markets you visit. Connect with us on Twitter at #EEMarket. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan. This is Earth Eats.